This is I Choose Life News and Views, sponsored by Indiana Right to Life and Allen County Right to Life, committed to defending innocent human life for all people of all ages. Your hosts are Kathy Humbarger, Abigail Eschelbach, and Scott Kump.
Welcome to I Choose Life News and Views. I'm Kathy Humbarger.
I'm Abigail Eschelbach.
And I'm Scott Kump. I Choose Life News and Views is a joint project of Allen County Right to Life, Indiana Right to Life, and Bot Radio Network in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
And now, the pro-life news.
This from Live Action News. A new rule proposed by the Department of Health and Human Services could prevent states from blocking Title X funding to abortion providers. Representative Diane Black of Tennessee has called out the proposed rule as another backdoor maneuver by the Obama administration to keep the money flowing to Planned Parenthood. In an opinion piece published by Fox News on Tuesday, September 20th, Black elaborated on her criticism of the proposed rule. In the piece, Representative Black pointed out that the White House praised what it said was Planned Parenthood's high ethical standard, at the same time that the abortion giant was implicated in a scandal involving the trafficking of baby body parts. According to Black, quote, "More recently, we learned from Planned Parenthood's own annual report that the organization saw an increase of $25 million in taxpayer funding, while the total number of medical services provided dropped by more than 10% during the same time frame," end quote. Black quipped that due to the influence Planned Parenthood holds over the government, Cecile Richards might as well be on the White House payroll. Citing her home state of Tennessee as an example, Black claims that community health centers, which are eligible to receive the Title X funding, have been identified in every county. Thus, funds could be redirected away from Planned Parenthood while still providing care for underserved women and families. She went on to call out the blatant use of biased sources in support of the new HHS rule. The Department of Health and Human Services cites research from the Guttmacher Institute six times in the proposed rule. As Black notes, the Guttmacher Institute, quote, "was formerly an entity housed within Planned Parenthood Federation of America and is even named after a former Planned Parenthood president," end quote. Black reports that she is currently gathering co-signers on a letter from members of Congress expressing opposition to the proposed rule and plans to use the power of Congress as well as the strength of the pro-life movement to defeat the new rule. You can find the entire news story at liveactionnews.org. You can also go to liveactionnews.org to link to Representative Black's entire Fox News opinion piece and to link to documents containing the complete language of the proposed HHS rule.
For the next 25 minutes or so, we're going to be having a conversation with Dr. Andrew Mullally of Credo Family Medicine. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Mullally.
Kathy, thank you for having me.
I understand that you're a native of Michigan and grew up in a medical family. So tell us a little bit about how you grew up and why medicine is a passion.
Yeah, my mom and dad are both family medicine doctors up in Michigan, and I really benefited from their experience. You know, I find a lot of children of doctors, they either veer straight towards medicine or straight away from it. So my folks, I'm very grateful because they showed me all the joys in the profession. And I found my way down to Fort Wayne when I was looking for a residency program that would respect my religious beliefs. And the folks here in Fort Wayne were only too kind. And I love my time here so much, we decided to stay.
Well, you're a bit of an anomaly in that you are starting your own practice, having finished your medical training. Typically, doctors join a large medical group or a hospital, but you're striking out on your own. Tell us a little bit about why you decided to take that route.
Yeah, you know, it's something that's kind of been on my heart for a long time. There's a lot of benefits of working with the big hospital systems. We got a lot of great hospitals here. They can provide a lot of infrastructure, but I feel that you do lose some of the individual relationship and customer service that can be provided by an independent doctor. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, in one situation, if you go to the hospital, you see a doctor there, you see some specialists, you go home and see a different doctor, nobody's really in charge of the care. We don't really know exactly what's going on. Whereas one of the things that I'm passionate about is I'll be with my patients every step of the way, mm-hmm. from the outpatient to when they're sick, I'll be able to see them in the hospital, even up to providing palliative and hospice care at the end of life. So I think it facilitates a better doctor-patient relationship, and I think I'm able to care for my patients in a better way.
In the time that I've gotten to know you, Dr. Mullally, I know that the life issue is extremely important to you. And one of your passions is the end-of-life issues. Being a young doctor, why has that gotten your attention?
You know, I see that as an opportunity, truthfully, with abortion. You know, so many are passionately, as well as me, passionately right to life and against abortion. But we've been working our way back and trying to regain rights for the unborn that we lost 30, 40 years ago. I see the end of life as an opportunity because this is a narrative that is being written right now. And so hopefully if we can kind of hold firm and not allow these rights to be trampled on, that will allow us a better position in the future and protect more patients.
An end of life isn't limited to those who are elderly. It can involve someone who has perhaps been in an accident. It can involve someone who has a chronic illness. It's not just limited to those who are on the elderly end of the life spectrum. Is that true?
That's completely true. I mean, we a lot of times have a connotation of what the end of life looks like. And usually we envision kind of an elderly person in a hospital bed and whatnot. The fact of the matter is when we get into the end of life issues, it actually ties very closely with the beginning of life, because looking at countries in Europe where these rights have been trampled on and things like euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide have been practiced for 30 years, mm-hmm. the number of atrocities that you see coming out of there, it's hardly believable. And it goes right across the life spectrum, such that in two of the countries in Europe, or at least one of them, I believe, there's no age limit. So even pediatric euthanasia, if the patient's at least 7 years old, they can consent for themselves. And if they're younger, it's up to the parents and the doctor to say, yeah, we don't think this child's life is worth living.
And I saw a news report within the last week, I think it was from Belgium, where that exact thing happened. So it's not in theory only. This is actually happening. I think the little girl was only 8 years old and chose euthanasia to end her life. This is an absolute atrocity. I can't even hardly believe what I'm reading. And this has come upon us so rapidly that I'm just so pleased that there are those of you in the medical profession who are speaking out, because other doctors listen to doctors. We want to talk about a huge victory that those of us who value life had here in Indiana at the Indiana State Medical Association meeting just in the last week or so. But before we do, it had to do with physician-assisted suicide. So let's unpack that term. What does physician-assisted suicide mean? Does it cover the issues that we've just been talking about?
It really does. And the main designation between physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia is the taking of the medicine. In euthanasia, it's usually an IV medicine that the doctor will push, just like another medicine in the hospital where they're actively killing the patient. For me, not a huge difference. Physician-assisted suicide is where the doctor gives the medicine to the patient and then they take it under their own power. Supposedly. I say that because there's no oversight there. They go home and take the medicine or are coerced to take it by someone else.
So this issue, I know you've been watching for a number of months. I believe earlier in the spring you saw this coming as a topic that was going to be discussed at the Indiana Medical Association meeting. And you've been on top of that in your role as a member of the Young Physicians Society and also the Catholic Medical Association. So what happened at the meeting last week, and what was the threat going into that meeting?
Yeah, I was so excited to see how everything happened there. The biggest threat came from Indianapolis. There's a misguided oncologist who was trying kind of, you know, this is the first year he's been involved, so it looks an awful lot like Compassion and Choice has kind of appointed him to bring this issue up.
And Compassion and Choice is an organization that's promoting this concept?
It is. It's formerly known as the Hemlock Society, but they found that was out of vogue. So now Compassion, that sounds nice. We're gonna call the pro-suicide people Compassion and Choices. That's their current name out of Colorado. But there's been a national push to bring this to many states. And in Indiana, this poor oncologist was the guy who brought this issue up, and he sent out a letter to folks in April stating, hey, I'd like your support. I'd like to just look at this, you know, very slow, very calm. This is not a big deal. Don't be alarmed. But rightfully, a lot of us were alarmed. And so we tried to take positions so that we could prevent that from happening.
And as you said, this has been a movement that's been taking place in other states. And some of the states that have already accepted this method of medical treatment, physician-assisted suicide, includes Oregon, Washington, Vermont, California, and Montana. So it seems that this is a growing number of states that are accepting this. So it's important that the doctors in the states are vigilant like you were. So this recommendation came up, and as I'm looking at the information that you shared with me, Dr. Mullally, the first thing on the list that the folks advocating for physician-assisted suicide gave as an argument is that it would decrease healthcare costs at the end of life.
Yeah.
Really?
You know, you look at that as a reason, and to myself, I'm thinking, man, this is like shooting fish in a barrel. Nobody would be moved by that. But the sad reality is a lot of people, you know, who do not value the sanctity of life created in the image of God, they value dollars and cents. And we know that about 60%, 60, of Medicare dollars are spent in the last 6 months of life. Mm. And so for folks who are worried about the cost of healthcare, however we can limit the cost of healthcare at the end of life, in their opinion, the best way to do that is to kill the patient. That's a victory for them. So I was surprised that was the angle they were pursuing, but that was one of the things that they brought up. And it fell on deaf ears with me. I can't imagine that most of our listeners would find that very appealing.
Especially those of my generation, because we're getting closer and closer to the age when this is going to be a very real issue for us to face. And maybe this would be a good place, Dr. Mullally, to discuss the difference between allowing someone to die and causing them to die. I know with the technology and the advances in the medical profession, there are a lot of things that can be done to keep a human body functioning.
Correct.
That's different from allowing them to die and making them to die. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Definitely. And I think there is an essential distinction there, getting right to the essence of the act. Whenever I look at an act, I try and look at three things. There's the object of the act, what you're actually doing. There's the intention that you have when you're doing it, and there's the circumstances surrounding it. So prescribing a medicine is not bad. It depends on the intention and circumstances. When the intention is to kill the person, that is a bad thing. Mm-hmm. If your intention is to help them, you could prescribe the same medicine, and it wouldn't be a problem. So a lot of it comes down to the intention, and then circumstances in this case don't really come into play, because the intention is kind of it's a non-starter. When you mm-hmm. want to kill your patient, that's something that is objectively morally evil. Mm-hmm. And so you can't really look any further than that.
So if someone's body is in the process of shutting down during the dying process, first let me ask you, is that an accurate medical phenomenon? Does the body shut down in the dying process?
You know, everybody's death is a little bit different. There are some that are quite rapid, and there are some that are quite slow. And nowadays, since we have so many medical technologies that we can help people with, death can even be quite confusing, especially folks who are kind of in a prolonged process of dying. We do a lot of different things to help them along the way until a point when we can't really help them any further. And so I think knowing that at all times we are working to save and protect the life of this patient and to follow their wishes. You don't have to pursue any of these treatments. You're always allowed to pass naturally on your own, and that's totally legitimate and a very reasonable thing to do depending on the clinical situation. But you cannot, especially as a physician, you can never intend that someone die because of your hand. Mm. That's not a physician. A physician's supposed to be a healer. This is an antithetical position where you're dealing out life and death like you're God, and we're not. Physicians are not God. We're simple tools if we're doing our job well.
So the second argument that the pro-physician-assisted suicide people advocated was that it would help patients who commit suicide to die in a more peaceful manner. What exactly does that mean?
You know, it was a confusing argument that I was surprised I brought up, but a physician shared a heartfelt story about a close friend and neighbor who received the diagnosis of a terminal condition and did commit suicide on his own. And this physician would have liked to help him to kill himself in a way that was more peaceful than the gory way that the patient decided to do it. And so, again, I think looking, especially when you look at the act, if somebody's going to do something bad, this is kind of the same thing as the back alley abortion argument. Just because they're going to do something bad, we can't help them do it in a safer way. That's us condoning their behavior, which is a bad behavior. And so for me, that was not very compelling, although I'm sure it's derived out of compassion and you want to try and help these folks, but suicide's not the answer. And even when you look at states like Oregon, where physician-assisted suicide's been legal since the 90s, suicide continues to rise there, even apart from physician-assisted suicide, because suicide's perceived as a good. And it's more natural for patients to think that that's how you're supposed to die when the doctors are advocating it. So you'll see even other suicides by firearms or hanging or whatever else, those will go up in number when physician-assisted suicide is legalized.
Don't you think this speaks to a bigger trend in our overall culture, Dr. Mullally, when it seems that our answer to problems is to eliminate any kind of suffering or discomfort? If you have a crisis pregnancy or an adverse prenatal diagnosis, well, let's get rid of the baby. If we have some kind of debilitating disease, well, let's look to stem cell research using embryonic stem cells to make my situation better at the expense of the child. If we have an elderly person or a disabled person who is causing us to expend extra energy and live sacrificially, well, let's get rid of the person that's causing that drain on my life. Am I over-dramatizing here, or do you think that there's a thread running through our maybe more selfish or narcissistic mindset that is causing us to look to death to solve our problems and make our lives easier?
No, I think you hit the nail on the head. And I mean, I look back even at the fall, you know, this is pride just in a different manifestation. Whenever human beings feel out of control, they want to solve the problem. And suffering is not seen as something that is redemptive. Christ suffered. Suffering is not a bad thing when it's united with Christ. It is seen as something in a utilitarian mindset that the only goal in life is to avoid pain. So whenever there's pain, whenever there's suffering, you have to try and eliminate it. Mm-hmm. And really, that's great hubris. That's great pride. And I think, you know, that's why we see so many of these actions leading to terrible consequences, because it is. It's a sinful mindset. And it's something that at every level, I think we've got to fight and say, you know, we are not the author of life and death. We're stewards of our life. And in that way, we're here to protect and use our gifts for what God would like us to do. But we're never allowed to say, you know what, I'm not going to die on God's terms. I'm going to die on my terms. And my last act on this earth is going to be one of defiance.
Right.
You know, and that's just a terrible mindset.
Well, the last argument that we're aware of that the physician-assisted suicide advocates used was, well, everybody else is doing it.
Right. I feel like my mom warned me against this kind of logic, you know, just because everybody else says they do it. And, you know, a lot of times the pro-assisted suicide people point to Oregon, point to Europe and say, oh, look how great it is. There's no problems. Well, the Oregon law was specifically written so that no data could be collected. And we don't actually know the outcomes, because if somebody has dementia and they commit physician-assisted suicide, the death certificate says dementia. It doesn't mention suicide at all.
Really?
So in that way, yeah, we really cannot track what's happening. And after the doctor prescribes the medicines in Oregon, the patient goes home. Most of them don't even take the medicine. So now we have this lethal medicine sitting around somewhere that could be used on someone else. A caregiver could coerce the poor person to take the medicine. You are being such a burden. Why don't you just go ahead and finish the job? I mean, you can envision all sorts of these different things, even apart from the cost control side of things, where we even know back a couple of years ago, the folks in Oregon who had cancer, their doctor prescribed a cancer-treating medicine like chemotherapy, and the insurance said, you know, we will not pay for that, but oh, by the way, you do have the option of assisted suicide. And so, I mean, that is the road. We don't even have to say, everybody bemoans the slippery slope argument. We only have to look back maybe 5-10 years. This is already happening.
Right.
So there's no hyperbole here. This is just factual things that we are seeing in different places.
And quite alarming and frightening at that. This is Kathy Humbarger. You're listening to I Choose Life News and Views. Our guest is Dr. Andrew Mullally. We're talking about physician-assisted suicide and the recent events that happened at the Indiana Medical Association meeting. Dr. Mullally, when this was discussed and came up in the meeting, was it an open and shut discussion? How did it unfold?
It's a pretty interesting process, and I've enjoyed getting involved and seeing it in action. You know, every year medical society will entertain resolutions, and the ones that are passed will be brought forward to our legislators and encouraged to become law. And
so there's more to this than just a resolution.
Correct. The goal is for there to be a statewide law reflecting the resolutions. And we do have legislators that look to the doctors, especially in matters of public health, as far as being authorities as to what they should promote in the state house. So during this conference, there was about 50 or so resolutions. About half of them get voted in favor of, half against. Intentionally, this one was left kind of for the end of the day. And it was really interesting to see because there was kind of the clear the benches moment when it was very clear that a lot of people were waiting for this. There were many people I talked to who said they had never been involved until they heard about this, and this motivated them to take the weekend, come down, speak out against this, speak on in favor of life, to ensure that, you know, our rights are not trampled. Because even apart from taking care of patients, as a physician, I'm always worried about the religious freedom and the religious liberty, which we know the trajectory has not been awesome the last 8 years especially. And so we want to do everything in our power to make sure that this stays illegal in Indiana. So when the moment actually came up, there were two resolutions. There was one from the poor oncologist down in Indianapolis and another one from a good friend of mine, Dr. Agnes Schrader. She's a nephrologist down in Noblesville, I believe, and she's the head of the American Academy of Medical Ethics. And she wrote a very eloquent resolution defending life and affirming our position against assisted suicide. And so these resolutions were considered at the same time. And so there was definitely a large number of people who wanted to speak. And there was really only three physicians who had the interest in speaking in favor of suicide. They went over the arguments that we just discussed. And then there was at least 15 or 20 doctors who came down, and everybody really had a different opinion that I tried to supply a couple of the arguments that they used for you. Everybody kind of brought their own story, their own life experience. We had doctors that were critical care ICU doctors. We had doctors that were parents of disabled children. We had doctors like myself, a family doctor. So I get to take care of patients of all ages. And so to see the way this affects patients, all of us are motivated by different things. And eventually, I think it led to be a very compelling argument. The reference committee that reviews these resolutions immediately recommended to vote against the assisted suicide and in favor of the one defending and protecting life, so that when it came down for the vote, it actually went with the consent agenda, which was wonderful. It wasn't even argued about on the second day, because I think everybody, you know, I've got to tip my hat to everybody who is willing to come down there in town. Dr. Eustace Fernandez, he's an ICU doctor at Lutheran. He took time out of his way to go down and speak, especially with his experience and many others of us. And I think the argument was just so compelling that it went with the consent agenda. So it was definitely a big victory moment. We were very happy.
Big win. So we could anticipate in the next legislative session, which is coming up the first part of 2017, that there might be legislation supporting life in these situations. Would that be true?
I would sure hope so, because that's what we do with all the resolutions, the ones that we pass. We try and get legislation in favor of that. I do have a strong feeling, and it seems like they've been dropping some hints, that the National Compassion and Choices Group is going to be bringing legislation in favor of assisted suicide, which I'm sure will get shot down. You know, we can keep that in our prayers, but I would love to see legislation reaffirming Indiana as a state being against this. The doctors are against this. The people are against this. As a state, we should come together and say that we reject this.
What I really appreciate, Dr. Mullally, is the proactive position that you took. Too often, this gets down the track and we find ourselves in a legislative session fighting this. But you saw this coming way back in the spring. You and your colleagues organized and put together a plan to fight this early on. I don't know if this has happened in just this way before, but I'm encouraged that we might see this kind of proactive approach taken by doctors when other issues come up that are very important to those of us who value life. Is that a fair assumption?
I think that's the best strategy moving forward. And that's something that motivates me a great deal, is that, you know, the kind of the public opinion, this is not something we think about on a daily basis. You know, maybe the folks in Oregon do, but here we said never in Indiana. The sad reality is that there's a lot of national money that is going to be trying to force us down our throats. And so the sooner we can stop it, the sooner we can change course. I think we're going to be more successful. So it just, for me, it underlined the importance of wherever is God has put you in your life, this is your vocation. And so you have to work for the kingdom wherever he puts you. And so this is where I am.
We certainly appreciate you not only taking action on this, but on other life issues as well. And I know you're a father of young children and you have a beautiful wife. So it's not as if you don't have other things that are very important in your life going on. But it is certainly encouraging for us to see you see the importance of being very actively involved in speaking out for life and stepping a little bit into the public policy arena to be a voice, because doctors listen to doctors. And I anticipate we're going to be hearing a whole lot more from you. Those of us who may have dealt with a situation where a family member has been injured and the issue comes up, maybe it's a fatal injury, but they're still alive. The issue comes up about organ donation. Could you just give us a couple of comments on what your position is on organ donation?
Yes, definitely. You know, organ donation is a very interesting thing, and I feel like there's more to unpack ethically as a society before I feel really comfortable endorsing it fully. You know, things like donating a kidney or part of your liver, very wonderful charitable things to do, and you can go on living without those organs. There's other donations such as the heart or lungs where that's incompatible with life. So I think there's definitely a place where if we know the patient has passed away and they are deceased, that making a gift of the organs is a very selfless thing to do to help someone else. However, the question and the primary concern would be, is the patient really dead or are they still dying? Mm-hmm. And if they're still dying, then removing their heart would be an act to kill them. And that's something that's definitely not licit. So I think we have to use extreme caution and utmost respect for life so that we don't abuse these poor people in the last moments of their life, treating them as a bag of organs rather than as a living human being created in God's image.
A lot more to this whole issue than meets the eye. So we appreciate your comments and we'll have you back at another time when we can spend a whole program talking about this. Dr. Mullally, thank you so much for being our guest today. And thank you for being on the tip of the spear as you continue to protect life in a very difficult situation. We'll have you back real soon.
Thank you, Kathy.
You've been listening to I Choose Life News and Views. If you have questions about this program or if you'd like to support the fight for life, please call 260-471-1849 or go to ichooselife.org, because without the right to life, no other rights matter.